Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Lee, when you look around at your options for the upcoming 2024 election, how do you feel?
I feel frightened, depressed, frustrated, confused.
There's a certain Eeyore-ish quality to the way Lee Drutman talks about the 2024 presidential field right now. Which is strange, because he's a political scientist.
It's a lot of time between now and 2024, but if it's Biden and Trump again, as it likely will be, I'm terrified of Trump, and I'm anxious about Biden. And I think a lot of people feel the same way.
This political malaise, some would blame the candidates for it. Some would blame the never-ending culture wars. But Lee thinks a little bigger, to the systems and structures that made those candidates and culture wars possible. Democrats, Republicans, he's looking at you.
Yeah, jokers to the left, jokers to the right.
Stuck in the middle with you.
Stuck in the middle? Are we stuck in the middle here?
There's ample evidence that Lee is not the only one feeling stuck. And he's not the only one blaming the major political parties for that feeling, either. A quarter of all Americans see both Democrats and Republicans unfavorably right now. Close to half of us call ourselves independents. But stuck, it's almost too mild of a word to describe what Lee's concerned about. He's worried about what happens when our political system tries to unstick itself. This is something the founders openly fretted about when they were plotting how the American system was going to work. John Adams said that a division of the Republic into two great parties is to be dreaded as the great political evil. Lee says the stuck feeling so many people have right now, it's a check engine light, and it's blinking.
When there are only two teams, there's no possibility for recombination. It's just us versus them, my side versus your side, and that's how democracies die. We look around the world and we see that there are a lot of democracies that are collapsing or have collapsed. And in every one of those democracies, what has happened before that collapse is society has fractured into two sides. And in such circumstances, one side says, well, the other side is so dangerous that we're going to change the rules and we're going to shut down this whole free and fair elections thing so our side maintains total power.
I mean, you're getting pretty dark here, but you do have a solution for all this. It just involves taking a sledgehammer to the current system, right?
Yeah, maybe it's a sledgehammer. I don't know. I try not to be too destructive here.
Lee's solution is moving beyond Democrat versus Republican, spawning more political parties, a lot more. If it was up to you, how many parties would the United States have?
I think five or six is probably about the right number of parties.
Five or six. That's a lot of people in the pool.
Is it? It's a big country.
Today on the show, on America's birthday, Lee's got a radical solution to a very American political predicament. He doesn't want a third party. He wants a fourth and a fifth, maybe even a sixth. So how's that all supposed to work? I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
Can I ask a dumb question? Why are there only two political parties in the U.S. in the first place?
The reason that we have just two political parties is because we have an electoral system of single winner elections that renders third parties as spoilers and wasted votes. So all of the organizing energy has gone into the two major parties.
So you're saying this is kind of organic, but can you just dig into this a little bit more? Like, how did this system grow up? Like, why is it that having a winner-takes-all approach incentivizes just two parties?
The reason that having a winner-take-all approach incentivizes just two parties is because nobody wants to support a party that can't win. And nobody who is ambitious in politics wants to be a candidate for a party that can't win. So all of the energy concentrates into the top two parties in a single winner system. And so third parties become fringe parties, spoiler parties. Occasionally they pop up, but mostly they remain on the margins because the system makes it hard for them to be seen as legitimate winners.
In the U.S., part of what made the two-party system workable for so long is that the two parties were big tents. Like, there were more conservative Democrats and more moderate Republicans. And so it was more like a four-party system that called itself a two-party system. So coalitions formed. When did that change?
So for a long time, we had a multi-party system within the two-party system. And really, that began to collapse in the 1990s.
How?
So you used to have a bunch of conservative Southern Democrats who represented a lot of places in the South. And in 1994, a lot of them got swept out of Congress in the midterm wave election of 94.
So this is like the Newt Gingrich change.
Now, we believe so deeply that we can deliver something that is very different, that we are prepared to be very specific about what we're doing.
And what Newt Gingrich did that was really transformative is he nationalized the elections.
We need to have a team which arrives in January already committed to spending the first 100 days in an aggressive, hardworking contract to deliver to the floor.
There were a lot of people who voted for Democrats for Congress and Republicans for president. And Gingrich said, well, if you like Republicans for president, you should vote Republicans for Congress. And so what used to be these two parties that had these broad geographic coalitions that included liberals and conservatives became two parties with really essentially non-overlapping geographical coalitions, which also reflected the cultural values. You have cities and coastal areas that are more liberal, more progressive, more cosmopolitan than ever. And you have more traditional rural, small town, ex-urban areas that are remaining traditional and feel that their way of life is increasingly under threat. And you have two parties that are still big tents, but the tents are not overlapping.
Yeah, I've read in your writing that you look to the 2010 midterm elections as another kind of turning point here, which is in the 90s, things were set up for this change, and then the Tea Party movement came along. Can you tell me how the Tea Party movement really, I guess, tightened the vise here, like made things even more extreme, I guess?
Right. Well, so what you see in 2010 is the final stage of the transformation into a flattened, genuine two-party system. Tea Party is, in many ways, a response to Obama's presidency. There are some darker, nativist, racist elements in this movement that start to really cast Obama as an enemy, as a threat. It really flattens politics into this really crystallized us versus them. So there's just no more compromise. There's no reason to work with Obama. Both Boehner and McConnell are pretty clear in that election that they want to make Obama a one-term presidency.
Boehner being the Speaker of the House at the time and McConnell being the leader in the Senate.
Right. That is the beginning, to me, of this escalating hyperpartisanship in which the Republican Party is increasingly tugged in a direction of, I would say, extremism. But you have to maintain that coalition. And the way you maintain that coalition is by the shared enemy, right? And you see a lot of the remaining moderate Republicans starting to feel like, well, I don't have a place in this party, so I'm going to retire. And who replaces them? Somebody who's very much in this Tea Party, MAGA, Freedom Caucus. There's a clear evolution here. The labels change, but the basic disposition towards politics as battle royale confrontation remains.
You've said that our system as it is now, this binary two-party system, directly disincentivizes active participation in democracy. But I'm wondering how, because it certainly didn't disincentivize the Tea Party. They became very active and tugged the whole thing towards them.
Well, it disincentivizes certain participation and incentivizes other participation. I think what happens when politics becomes this incredibly heightened emotional anger and fear-driven activity, it engages certain types of actors and disengages other actors. So, and the funny thing is, we've had some of the highest participation elections in U.S. history the last couple of years. So people are voting, but I wouldn't say that that's a sign of the health of our democracy. People are voting because they're scared of the alternative. And it's really a politics of fear and existential threat. And these are emotions that shut down reason and rationality and future thinking and make us just kind of dumb about politics and are also easily exploited. When we're afraid, we are likely to believe things that aren't true. We are likely to give money to causes that are just grifts. And we become nasty and angry towards each other. So this is a reinforcing cycle, of course, in which we become angrier and nastier, and politicians exploit that. And politicians think that that's what people want them to be. So they engage in those activities more, which then just reify that this is a moment in which we have to fight like hell or else we're not going to have a country.
Other countries do things differently than we do. And I think if it was up to you, would work a lot more like them. Can you walk me through an example of a small D democratic country like maybe Ireland or Denmark or Germany that's managed to incentivize, you know, beyond growth beyond a political binary?
Yeah. So just focus on Germany because it's the biggest. Germany has essentially a six-party system. And there is a far-right party that people probably know a lot about because they read a lot about it, the AfD. But that party is pretty much topped out at 10 or 15%. Then there's an old communist party that's like 5%. And what you have really are four major center parties. You have the center-left party, the Social Democrats, center-right party, Merkel's party, the Christian Democratic Party or Christian Democratic Union. And then you have a Green Party that's very different than the U.S. Green Party, more of a real environmental party, and the Liberal Party, which is sort of like a soft libertarian party. And pretty much every government is some coalition of those four parties. And politics is broadly in the center. But in all of the regions of the country, all six parties get some representation in a proportional system.
So what I'm hearing you saying, you're kind of poo-pooing it, but part of what you're saying here is that there are literal neo-Nazis who are empowered in parliament. And I think a lot of Americans might hear that and think like, whoa, do we want that in our country?
I mean, this is fundamentally the challenge of political extremism, right? And the AfD, if you look at international rankings of political parties and how illiberal they are, by the standards of political scientists who look at these political parties, the Republican Party and the AfD actually look pretty similar in their platforms and positions.
You're saying we already kind of have these folks in,
right,
in our political system. It's just that they're now able to tug more moderate Republicans to their point of view because they're all in the same boat together.
Right. Exactly. So the fundamental question is, so in every Western country, every Western democracy, there is some percent of the electorate that holds pretty far-right nationalist nativist views. That just seems to be the case. Now, question is, do you want to give them their own political party and institutionalize that, but essentially say, you know, they're going to have some share of the electorate, so they're going to get some share of seats, so they're going to get some representation, but we're going to have a system in which nobody wants to make a coalition government with them.
You're talking about a harm reduction approach to politics, which is acknowledging that really onerous people, people with onerous beliefs, will be involved in the political system. And do you want to minimize their impact or do you want to not?
Yeah. For a long time, people said, well, the two-party system is great because it encourages moderation. And that held as long as the moderates in the Republican Party had the upper hand and they could essentially run the party. But once the liberal extremists gained the upper hand in the Republican Party and they took over one of the two major parties, now, that's kind of game over, right? Because there's no way for a third party that is a moderate center-right party to emerge. If you think about how Kevin McCarthy has operated in the House, in order to become Speaker, he could only build one coalition. And that coalition included all of the Republican members of Congress. That meant that that the center had very little leverage because the right was very demanding. And without them, they couldn't form a coalition.
I think the thing that's hard for me to hear as a listener, when we look at Germany as an analog for the United States, it feels a little bit like giving up to say, well, we need to make room at the table for people with really racist beliefs because they're not going away. And the best we can do is try to minimize them in this way.
And why does that seem that like giving up?
Well, wouldn't you want to eliminate the awful racist beliefs?
I mean, you would, but how do you do that? Perhaps over time, over generations, those beliefs will go away. Usually happens with generational change, but I mean, this is a fundamental challenge of living in a democracy, is that you have to accept that we are all in this together and we are all equal.
After the break, could any of this work in a country as diverse and huge as America? Or does our size just further prove how essential it all is?
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
So how would empowering more parties work in the U.S. right now? Because as we've laid out, third-party candidates, they happen all the time here, but they essentially act as spoilers. They siphon off a few percentage points of votes, and they make it so that sometimes people are winning seats in, say, Congress without a majority of voters voting for them. So how would this work if we really wanted to put in place a more robust system where there were more candidates and more options for voters?
Fundamentally, we need to move away from our system of single member districts and need to move to a system of proportional voting for the U.S. Congress.
So right now I vote for like one guy who represents my area, and you're saying I should vote for what, like five guys who represent a bigger area?
No, you still vote for one guy, or maybe better yet, one woman to represent you. But there will, so you get one vote. But now in a, so you currently vote in a single member district, as does every American citizen. But imagine if you had a five member district in which you still vote for one person, but there were five representatives. So now a larger area gets five representatives. They represent different parts of that electorate.
Because essentially what you're doing is you're electing like a top five list. Like, I'm going to hopefully elect someone who's on that list, but they may not have won the majority of the vote. In fact, they definitely didn't, probably, because there are so many candidates.
Right. If it's a five-member district with 60% Democrats get three seats, and you vote for one of those Democrats who you want to represent you. So now Democrats could put forward a more diverse list within that system, rather than trying to find one candidate who is more than likely going to be an older white male. But you could have a more diverse list. Republicans would win two seats. They could put forward two different candidates. Or maybe you'd have... ideally, you'd have more parties. You'd have a moderate Democratic Party, a progressive Democratic Party, a moderate Republican, maybe a more extreme Republican. They'd probably go by different names. But
this sounds so complicated. Like, I'm trying to imagine, like, what am I voting for? And I guess I can see the advantages, right? Because it makes me think about, like, am I voting for a person or am I voting for these ideas? And I feel like I see how that's advantageous, right? It's getting me to not think cult of personality style.
Right. It's different. It's definitely different. But it, in most democracies around the world, this is how people vote. And they don't find it too complicated. What we have right now is an overly simplistic system in which, you know, there's two parties and most people vote for one party their entire life. So whoever that party puts forward as a candidate, they're going to vote for. And that's really simple. But it's so simple that it makes us dumb.
A lot of the countries you've talked about, places that already have this multi-party democracy happening, they're much smaller than the U.S. Has anyone tried this at this scale?
I mean, the EU is becoming more and more of a powerful political institution, and the EU uses a proportional voting system to elect its members. I mean, the U.S. is a distinct country. I mean, you know, and like I look at the largest countries in the world, and it does create some governing challenges, and this is why there are a lot of people who think, well, you know, maybe we should focus more on governing at the states and let the states have more power. And so ultimately the question is, what type of party and voting system gives us the most chance at solving these problems? When I look at the system that we have now and the way it enforces this arbitrary binary and drives all of our ancient us versus them mental circuits and just really kind of makes us stupid about politics, I say, this system is clearly not working. Now, can I promise that another system is going to work? I'm not going to make such promises, but based on what I see around the world and based on the underlying political science, I think it's our best shot.
Lee, I'm really grateful for your time. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, it was my pleasure, Mary. Really enjoyed this conversation. I think it's such an important issue, and I'm glad we are having this conversation.
Lee Drutman is a senior fellow at New America's Political Reform Program. He's also the host of the podcast Politics in Question and the author of Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop. His work is part of a special series Slate's got going on America's two-party system. You can check out all the great work over at slate.com/party. All right, that's the show. If you're a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to support us is to join Slate Plus. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus and show us some love. What Next is produced by Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, Paige Osborne, and Madeline Ducharme. We are led by Alicia Montgomery, with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Go track me down on Twitter, say hello. I'm at Mary's desk. Thanks for listening. Catch you back here tomorrow.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queen say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.